You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 345 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Batman White Knight Presents Generation Joker number 3, Batman Superman World's Finest number 17, Green Lantern number 2, Hawk Girl number 1, Night Terrors Catwoman number 1, Night Terrors Nightwing number 1, Night Terrors Punchline number 1, Night Terrors Superman number 1, Night Terrors Wonder Woman number 1, and the Blue Beetle movie. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC News, Batman Offworld, a 6-issue miniseries that will be written by Jason Aaron with art by Doug Mankey and inker Jaime Mendoza. A routine night in Gotham City for a young Batman proves to be anything but routine when the crime fighter is confronted with a sort of foe he's never faced before, one from beyond the stars. A universe of possible alien threats leads Batman to make a daring decision, to venture alone into the far reaches of the cosmos for the very first time, where the Dark Knight will face the fight of his life. Batman Offworld number 1 will release Tuesday, November 21st.
I'm pretty intrigued by this, Drew. I think for our listeners who are also Marvel fans, they're definitely going to recognize the Jason Aaron name. He's been big over there for years. Thor was definitely, I would say, his most widely acclaimed run, and he's certainly done quite a bit over there, and it makes sense that if he's coming over to DC that he'd do something cosmic, because all of his Thor stories were high fantasy, but they were cosmic high fantasy. And I'm really kind of curious to see what he does with Batman. I think this is definitely, I mean, it's Batman, so it's already got an audience, right? But I think Jason Aaron coming over to do it is also going to have a pretty sizable built-in audience for this book. So I'm looking forward to it, and I think it has a pretty good chance of being a success for for DC, which is definitely something they need.
Yeah, and I'm planning on reviewing this one, so. All right, up next for DC News, the dynamic duo are back once again with a brand new Batman and Robin comic coming in September from DC, written by Joshua Williamson and drawn by Simone DiMio. The new series will focus on the relationship between Bruce and Damian Wayne as they try to reconcile their roles as superheroes with their lives as father and son, as well as battling the usual rogues gallery. Williamson has teased Killer Croc and the Terrible Trio will feature in the series. Batman and Robin will face a new villain in the form of Shush, a female counterpart with a mysterious connection to the classic Batman baddie, Hush.
Well, that's my most succinct reaction to that news.
Now, I didn't say if this was supposed to be an ongoing or a miniseries.
I don't care. It's just all of the worst parts of Williamson, especially, like, it's just his inability, Drew, his inability to leave other stuff alone. He just can't do it. I understand part of comics is going back and grabbing characters and doing new stuff with them, and I totally get that, but he always has to do it in, like, the worst Williamson way possible. So you can't just do a Hush story, Drew. No. You have to introduce Shush, the female version of Hush, which everybody has been clamoring for. My God, Drew. I can't stand the guy. And it just drives me bonkers that he's got such heavy sway with what DC's putting out.
Yeah. And it's not that good.
Oh, I mean, clearly there's an audience out there. Like, I have to be honest. Because if he wasn't selling at all, he wouldn't be being handed these books. Like, there is clearly an audience out there that really likes his stuff, and I'm glad that they do, you know, because comics are for everybody. For me, it's just not for me. And his vision has become so ubiquitous with what DC is doing. It's a frustrating time for someone who doesn't like what his writing style.
All right, up next for DC News, Wonder Woman 3 not currently in development at DC. Despite Gal Gadot's tease, a report from Variety confirmed that the third Wonder Woman film is not currently in development at the studio. Despite recent comments from franchise star Gal Gadot suggesting as much. According to their reporting, new DC Studios CEO James Gunn and Peter Safran do not have plans at this time to develop a Wonder Woman project in their new DC universe outside of the already announced Paradise Lost prequel series that will air exclusively on Max. This comes after Galdo told comicbook.com in a recent interview that she had met with Gunn and Safran and had talked about developing Wonder Woman 3. Announced earlier this year, Paradise Lost is expected to be a Game of Thrones style prequel series revolving around the politics of the Amazons prior to Diana Prince's birth.
I am honestly not shocked by this news, Drew, because to be completely frank, it was more surprising that they were doing something with her. It just doesn't jive with the total reboot that it seems like they want to do, and I honestly think they need to do. That's not meant to be an indictment of Gal by any mean whatsoever. She's a fantastic Wonder Woman. I think so many people are a fan of her. That being said, that universe is toxic in the box office, Drew. I don't know that it's possible for a film set in that world to do well right now. I just don't think it is. I think everybody knows that it's bad. Overall, the world overall has been bad, that it's been discarded also, so why would you go see it? I'm not saying that they can't keep her as Wonder Woman, but it would be... I don't know that it would be the smartest move, Drew. And it's not, again, is not to do with her ability to play the character at all. I think they need a clean slate, and you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you want a clean slate, it's got to be a total clean slate.
Now with the reflecting reports we're getting, I have a feeling she has met with James Gunn and Peter Safran. I have a feeling she mistook what they were talking about. That's my feeling.
Or she was trying to pull a Rock move and pressure the studio into doing what she wanted. You don't know. I mean, we don't know. I agree, Drew. I'm sure she's met with them. I'm sure she has, because he's met with a lot of the former Justice League actors. We know he's met with Momoa. We know he talked and met with Cavill, and they went in a different direction for Superman. I don't think that door is closed. I think the important thing with that report is that at this time they're not doing that. I think there's a possibility, Drew, that they ultimately do keep her as Wonder Woman. Again, I'm not sure that that's the right idea or not, but it won't be soon. So much of this hinges on how Superman does, right? All of these conversations and all of these other projects that we're talking about, none of it's going to matter if Superman bombs. None of it's going to matter. DC's going to have to immediately recalculate what they're doing. And ultimately, probably what we're going to get is to go back to something in the mid-2000s where we just get Batman movies. But if Superman does really well and that world takes off, which is the dream, right? As DC fans, that's what we're hoping for. I mean, I think at that point, maybe you have a little more slack. Then you can mess around and see if you can get away with keeping Gal. But you can't commit to that right now.
Yeah, I don't. I'm really hoping Superman Legacy does well. If it doesn't, I don't want to go back to even as big of as a Batman fan as I am. I just don't want to have only Batman movies. I want to see some of the other I want to see some of the other characters. So I'm hoping, you know, even if it does fail, they'll still try to do individual movies, even if they're not connected in a universe. They don't have to be connected in a universe to get good movies.
Yeah. I don't know how they'll do, though. I mean, the movie we're going to talk about on tonight's episode, Drew, I think this is a good example of what that version of that world could look like, where we just get intermittent individual stories, and they're just blips at the box office. I don't want just Batman movies, to be clear, Drew. I fully agree with you. But let's be real. I mean, that's what it's going to... The only character in both comics and film for DC that consistently succeeds is Batman. It's the one franchise we know for sure is going to keep going. Other than that, I'm sure they'll try again, Drew, but it's going to be it. I honestly think if they shoot their shot with Superman and it doesn't work, you can't try again in a year, right? Like it's just not going to work. That you're it's gonna they would have to wait a while before actually seriously trying again. They'd have to wait, Drew. And at that point, I mean, it probably already is too late, but it's definitely going to be too late in 10 years. I'm not trying to be like, again, I'm optimistic about Superman. I really do think it's going to be good because I believe in Gunn's vision, both as a director and in his, understanding of DC characters. I believe in that film. But if it doesn't work, we're just not, DC fans are never going to get what Marvel has gotten.
I totally agree with you. All right, let's move on to our last bit of DC news. The Flash movie is coming to Max Friday, August 25th, which is in 2 days, which surprised me because originally I heard rumors of it not coming out till mid-September in October. And then all of a sudden we got the news it was coming really soon. I was like, oh, cool. And I don't know if that has anything to do with Blue Beetle coming out or what.
I mean, my guess, Drew, there's no way it's making anything right now digitally. I mean, other than just like the smallest pittance of money. You might as well put it on Max. Let's be honest, like the best viewership spike that they're gonna get is when they put it on Max. So why wait? I agree, if you wait a little bit, you could make a little bit more money, but there's no way. There's no way, given what we saw at the box office, that waiting a month for it to stay on digital on demand is going to bring them anything worthwhile.
And they could have decided to release it all of a sudden out of the blue because they weren't making any money for the digital release.
Yeah, and again, I think optimistically you're hoping for a word of mouth boost where people are like, "Hey, this isn't as bad as what we had heard," And it really isn't. Again, the movie is not bad. It's not DC's best film, but it's not bad. And so I think best case scenario for DC is that it goes out on Max and people actually do watch it and go, "Oh, actually, not the disaster it's been portrayed to be."
And me, I'm planning on watching it again here soon in the next few weeks because it's going to be on Max and I want to see it again. All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Soul Forge Podcast. It's a geeky look at love, life, fandom, mental health, pop culture, and so much more. If you're into learning about yourself and the universe, Soul Forge is your podcast. Each week, we have a surprising new topic, from stupid things we do for love to product reviews, and there's almost always a fun guest host. Like and subscribe to Soul Forge Podcast today.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And we host the Watchathon of Rassilon,
a podcast where we're watching through all of classic Doctor Who.
Nope, we've already done that.
We did? Well, then now what do we do?
What do we two do? We review New Who.
Ooh, we two review New Who?
We do, just for you.
Who?
Not you, them, the listeners of the podcast.
Ah.
The Watchathon of Rassilon.
Now we review New Who too.
Woohoo!
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk. Batman White Knight presents Generation Joker number 3. Axis Chemicals. Bryce is excited that there are a bunch of people cheering for his dad. Jackie disagrees, stating that there are a bunch of psychos devoted to a fantasy. To prove he is right, Bryce reveals the device that contains Jack's hologram. Suddenly, the gang members fight over who is going to control the Joker. During the scuffle, the hologram drive is damaged. Harley and Neo Joker come smashing through a window to battle against the gang members. Bryce and Jackie take off in the Batmobile. Axis Chemicals is blown up by one of the gang members. Both Harley and Neo Joker make it out before the explosion. Jackie calls Harley and tells her that their dad is broken, but they think they can bring him back. They take him home to Arkham. Jackie and Bryce make their way through Arkham to the lab they need. When they walk through the door of the lab, they find Mr. Freeze there pointing a gun at them. To be continued.
I don't have much to add, Drew, from my previous thoughts on this comic. I just am continually shocked at how much I dislike this book. Nothing else in the White Knight universe. I haven't loved everything they've done, Drew, but I have not disliked this. But this book has just, for me personally, been brutal. The plot is dumb, in my opinion. The writing, the dialogue is brutal. You got the scene where they like so ham-fistedly give Neo Joker a new name, Riot, was just so like stare straight into the camera and say the movie title name. My God.
I didn't care for this that much either. And the story seems like the whole purpose behind it is to bring back Jack. And, you know, I've moved on from Jack. I don't want him to come back. And
it's lazy. It's lazy. It's the lazy thing to do. It's the lazy, easy thing to do where, again, it's the trying to have your cake and eat it too, where you've told this story where one of the major consequences of this overarching story is the death of Jack being the good part of the Joker and just completely undoing it because you really like that character. Like, that's lazy. And that's just what a lot of this story has been to me, Drew. I mean, like, the scene with the son is just, like, unfathomably stupid, Drew, where he reveals that they've got the Joker in a hologram. Like, that is, you can't convince me that that kid is that dumb and a functioning member of society. I know kids do stupid things, Drew, but that's, I mean, that's next level. And he realized, and then the story, but this is the thing, and the writers know that it's really stupid because they have him acknowledge it himself within three panels of doing it.
I really don't have anything to add.
Yeah. I have found it to be shockingly lazy. I thought one of the things that has been a defining feature of all of these White Knight stories is the daringness to do something different with the Batman story, right? To go in a different direction where Bruce isn't actually a Wayne, right? Or the Joker isn't actually fully a bad guy or whatever. Whatever you have. I feel like he's made interesting, different, bold decisions, right? And this is the exact opposite of that. This is the easy, lazy way out is to be like, and then we magic Joker back into the story. It's disappointing because it's not what this world has been.
Agreed. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Batman Superman, World's Finest Number 17. Numezo takes Batman captive by using the Lasso of Truth. Before Numezo can kill Batman, Supergirl and Martian Manhunter show up to battle him. Batman escapes and meets up with Magnus, creator of the Metal Men. Superman, Wonder Woman, the Captain, and Green Lantern join the fight against Numezo and are losing. Magnus uploads a program that turns Numezo's AI companions against him. The original Amazo battles Numezo, which causes them to automatically replicate each other. They are trapped in an energy feedback loop that causes them both to shatter. Metamorpho finishes off Numezo. The heroes help with the cleanup and fixing of their robotic friends. Next, the untold origin of the Batman-Superman team, plus the return of Boy Thunder.
I wasn't totally satisfied with the... I haven't loved this storyline, Drew, and we talked about this last time. I didn't think it was bad. It was just very safe. I don't know. It was easy. The ending was really easy, it felt to me. Like, you have a new Mazo reach the peak of his powers, right? Everything looks lost, and then Batman's like, but wait, there's more, and then it's resolved within a couple pages, and it just felt easy. and convenient. I don't know. It just was not a satisfying conclusion.
No, and I'd already written this off after last issue. I was done with the story. And I'm looking forward to moving on to the next arc.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It was just disappointing because Wade is certainly over many, many years of writing, we've seen a lot of better stories and is capable of a much better climax to even a mediocre story like this. It was just such a flat climax to the story. It felt very paint by numbers. Like if you were to do, like, it, honestly, Drew, it felt like if you were to have an AI write a comic book, it would generate something along the lines of this story, if I'm being completely honest with you.
Yeah, I agree with you. And who knows, maybe an AI wrote it.
That would be fitting. Frankly, Drew, it would actually make the story more interesting.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Green Lantern number 2. 1 month ago, Hal Jordan is about to be vaporized by a guy wearing Manhunter armor when he suddenly yanks out the Owen energy from the suit and forms a ring out of sheer willpower. Hal decides to test the ring by stopping the demolition team after a heist. The team ducks into a cemetery. Hal uses his ring to create ghosts to frighten the demolition team into giving themselves up to the police. Hal Jordan decides to take a quick flight into space, but when he reaches 330,000 feet above the surface, the edge of space, his Green Lantern outfit disappears and he plummets back toward Earth. Present day, Hal Jordan rides his motorcycle back home to his brother's camper. The Poozer is welcomed home by Kilowog, who has an ice-cold dew of the mountain waiting for him, though Kilowog claims it tastes like Andorian puddle water. The next day, Carol Ferris and her fiancé go to board the company private plane and learn that Hal Jordan is the new first officer. A camera allows the crew to check on the passengers from the cockpit, where Hal can see that Carol and Nathan are enjoying a glass of wine. Hal jerks the plane, causing Carol to spill wine all over Nathan's suit. Hal tells the pilot that he is right, this isn't like a fighter jet at all. Hal excuses himself to check on the passengers. When Nathan goes to the restroom to clean himself up, Hal locks the door with his power ring. Hal apologizes to Carol about the turbulence and checks to make sure everything is okay. Carol states that it is not okay. The pilot shouts for Hal when he sees ghosts and goblins flying in the sky with them. To be continued in Night Terror's Green Lantern number 1. We also had Rise of the Revenant Queen Part 2. Earth Zero. John Stewart is doing yard work with his mother outside. In another universe, Lantern Shepherd is fighting against the Revenant Queen. When Lantern Shepherd is about to be killed, John Stewart shows up. Lantern Shepherd recites the oath while John Stewart transforms into his costume. Continued in Green Lantern number 3, on sale in September.
Drew, I want to talk about the John Stewart part first. It's fine again, which is sort of what I felt about the first one, but I think I said this last time, I feel like they're trying way too hard with John Stewart, Drew. Like, I feel like if I'm being honest, it feels like they're overcompensating. It feels like they feel like they need to have John Stewart be portrayed as bigger and better than the rest of the Green Lanterns, which is fine. If they want him to be the best, that's fine with me, Drew, but like, I want to see him actually just be a Green Lantern. And I feel like they constantly are just falling into this trap of like, well, if he's going to be the biggest and the best, then we got to go above and beyond and do something different. And it's like, well, I mean, like, sure, but what if you just made him a Green Lantern? Like, what if he was just a really good Green Lantern? What if we got a story like we get with Hal in the lead part of this story? It's John, right? And it's John's character. So it's, you know, obviously not the same plot as what Hal's doing. But it's just following him just being a Green Lantern. I would love that. I feel like a lot of people would really like that, Drew. I don't need to see him being a god or being the greenest lantern to ever lantern. Like, just let me see him be a Green Lantern and be great. Because he is. He's a great character. It just feels like they're trying too hard, Drew. When the answer's just right there, just let him be a fantastic Green Lantern. I would love that story.
I agree with you, Cletus. And one of the things they could do that they're not is they could be showing us what's going on in the rest of the galaxy with Jon Stewart, if he's still part of the Green Lantern Corps. And he's out in space. We can see what's going on because we know the Guardians have disappeared. And we know that United Planets have taken over the Corps. And it'd be interesting to see what's going on in the rest of the galaxy besides just seeing Hal trapped on Earth. So they could be using Jon Stewart to show us what's going on in the rest of the galaxy. And I think that would be really interesting.
Agreed. I completely. I don't think that the first two issues that we've gotten with John have been fine, but both times, especially after reading Hal's story, which I have loved these first two issues of Hal Jordan drew. Oh my God. Reading those and then getting to the John Stewart backup, which feels more like the not great Green Lantern stories we've been getting for the past 5 or 6 years, it's disappointing because it's like, man, I would love to get the same feeling that I'm getting with these Hal stories. I'd love that feeling with John. I would love that. And I don't think it's that hard. I just feel like they're trying to do too much. And the answer, look at the Hal Jordan story, Drew. They're not trying. It is the most stripped down, back to basics Green Lantern story you can do, and it's fantastic. I love it. Drew, these first two issues have felt like classic Hal and felt like a classic Green Lantern story that we haven't gotten in years. In years. It's so good. And you absolutely can do that with John, too. It doesn't... Obviously, I'm biased because Hal is personally my favorite Green Lantern. But you can absolutely do a story like this. Again, obviously changing things because John is a different person and is going to act a different way. But you could do a story like this that is a back-to-basics Green Lantern story with John Stewart as the main character, and it would be a brilliant, fantastic book. It could literally be any of them. You could do the same thing with Jessica. You could do the same thing with Baz if they remember that he exists. You know, they can do it with Kyle. It can be any of them. And I just, when you read what they're doing with Hal, and I love what they've done with Hal these first two issues, it makes me want to see what they can do with the other ones. It's just frustrating that they're doing something totally unnecessarily different with John.
I love this issue myself. And I was very surprised when Hal went home and we saw the "Hey, Poozer!" And I was like, yes, because I didn't think we were going to get to see any other Green Lantern characters with Hal basically being trapped on Earth. And I was very happy to see Kilowog. I thought that was a great addition to the issue. Added comedy to it. I love the fact that Hal wasn't doing so good at Ferris Air. So what's he do? He goes and gets another job working for a different company, but, you know, being in proximity to Carol. I thought that was freaking hilarious.
Yeah.
So, and then the turbulence thing and stuff. I know. This issue was great. I loved it.
It's so good. I feel like they just get the Hal character, Drew. I feel like they get him. You got that, like, that true, deep passion for flying. I know that seems like such a basic thing, but, like, that is one of the most defining characteristics of Hal, is that his love of flying is a defining characteristic for him. And it's one of the main reasons he likes being a Green Lantern, is because he can fly in the most unrestricted sense possible. And they capture the kind of humor of his character, but also the fact that he's kind of a dick, right? Like, Hal is not the nice guy that Barry is, right? He's never been that. And they get that. Like, not everything he does in this story is likable, right? Like, it's funny and it's very entertaining, but you're not necessarily rooting for him in some of these situations. And that's, to me, that's perfect because that's Hal. He's not, he's got a lot of rough edges to him.
We saw Hal fly up into space, and as soon as he reaches the edge of Earth's atmosphere, we see his costume totally disappear. Now, we know he made that ring, so I'm guessing it's not connected to the Green Lantern. It's not connected to the Green Lantern network at all, is what I'm guessing. And from what I've seen, it's limited to Earth. Now, do you think that the United Planets made that happen, or that was just a restriction of his ring not being connected to the Green Lantern network?
I feel like the ring is connected to Earth, Drew, which, if that's the case, I love that decision because they are writing in a restriction for his character and for the story, right? They are putting like a ceiling on the scope of the story, which I kind of like. We've talked about this before. Obviously, Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run is one of the all-time runs of superhero comics. It's brilliant. One minor nitpick I have of that run is that it also starts at the ground level and starts with Hal mainly doing Earth stuff, but it escalates quickly. It's within 6 issues. He's up in space, and that dude doesn't really return to Earth again. I mean, he does, but it's always cosmic battle stuff. It's not, you know, back to ground level stuff. I like this. I think they are tying the ring to Earth, implying that he can't be Green Lantern off of Earth. And for what this story is trying to do right now, Drew, I love it. Obviously, they're telling the readers what to expect, but they're also kind of putting a restraint on themselves, right? Because it's so easy to fall into the like, oh, well, we could have Sinestro pop up and then he chases him off to, you know, to another planet. And it's like, well, no, that's not really what we're doing, though. We're doing an Earth story. And you can't, if you tie that ring to Earth, it forces you as the writer to stay on Earth and keep it at that ground level story. And to me, that's what this needs right now. I'm not saying that they can't eventually graduate again to space opera, because that's Green Lantern too, right? But I kind of love the decision, I'm not going to lie.
I like it too. And I have a feeling that they want to explore that other mystery, but they're going to be on Earth for a while. It feels like the long game to me. And
it does.
And I'm excited about that. I'm hoping this title sticks around.
That is something that is really encouraging to me, Drew, because I totally agree with you. It is being written for, it feels like it's meant to go on for a while. And obviously you don't know. And that could potentially be a risk. That's to be fair, because I've leveled that as a criticism in other books, but Green Lantern is more likely than, you know, it's like, he's like at the Barry Allen and Aquaman level where they're more likely to get some leniency on the book. I hope this does stick around and get a chance. It's been so good, and I know there are a lot of Green Lantern fans, so I'm hoping that this appeals to other fans the way it has appealed to you and I, because I would very much like to read along. If what we get in the future is what we've been getting, man, we could be in for a treat.
I totally agree with you, and I'm excited about that. I mean, this is the best Green Lantern we've seen for a while, since the Johns run.
I would agree. And again, we want to see, hopefully, you know, it's only been 2 issues to be fair, so we've got to see it sustained, but man, it's a very, very strong opening 2 issues. And I don't think even just a 2 issue stretch, I don't think there's been anything I've enjoyed as much since John's left.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Hawk Girl number 1. Gardenstown, 50 years ago, a young girl named Marine is playing with wooden horses in her front yard when a strange woman named Vulpecula approaches her with a gift. It is a fox necklace that will give her whatever her heart desires. Marine must agree to never take it off and give Vulpecula what she wants the next time they meet. Yesterday, Marine is riding her horse when she is attacked by a humanoid fox. Metropolis, today. Hawk Girl, Black Canary, Power Girl, and Superman are fighting armored fire aliens. Hawk Girl gets blasted by one of the aliens and her wings retract. Hawk Girl falls from the sky, unable to open them. Just before she hits the ground, Hawk Girl is saved by a superhero named Galaxy. Hawk Girl returns the favor by throwing her mace at an oncoming fire alien. Galaxy explains that the fire aliens are more than gas animating suits of armor. She has the ability to render them inert. Kendra meets an old college friend named Abilene, who is divorced and gay. After talking a few minutes, Abilene asks Kendra if she has any shot of dating her. Kendra states she is not looking for a relationship right now. Elsewhere, Marine is trapped inside a tube filled with green liquid. Vulpecula explains that the fox necklace is made of nth metal. Since Marine has worn it for half a century, her body should be suffused with a nth metal essence by now. Hawk Girl calls Batman and asks about a woman named Galaxy. Batman explains that she came to Earth 12 years ago and adopted the name Taylor Barzelay. She has the ability to perceive and manipulate energies that surround her. She currently lives with her girlfriend, Catherine Silverberg, on the top floor of a building. Elsewhere, Vulpecula throws a switch. Hawk Girl is shocked with electricity and falls through the roof of Galaxy Girl's apartment. To be continued.
Drew, there were parts of this comic that I was very intrigued by. The Vulpecula, I don't like the name. They're trying to be too clever with combining Fox and Dracula. It doesn't work when you actually say the name. It just sounds silly. But I liked the idea of the character. And to be fair, I don't know if they made that character up or not. That might be a pre-existing character. I was intrigued by her story. I was especially intrigued by the sort of deal with the devil we got when she initially gives the girl the necklace. I kind of wish we had gotten more with that. It would have been kind of cool to see that girl growing up. The implications that the only thing she ever wished for was the horse, which seems really small dreams and really undeserving of the fate that she ultimately receives. Like, I think part of the thing that works when you do deal with the devil stories, Drew, is you make the person who makes that deal kind of deserve it by the end, right? That they start to abuse that power and you're like, yeah, you sort of deserve to be punished. That didn't totally stick here because the poor girl, it's a little tiny girl and she wishes for a horse, Drew. And that, as far as we can tell, it's the only thing she wished for.
Yeah, that they show us. But I have a feeling that she used the power more over the years. They just didn't show it to us.
But you didn't show us. So how do we know? That I would have liked to have seen more of that. I'm interested in potentially whatever they're doing with Hawk Girl exploring her wings. That could be an interesting story. I just felt like they were trying to... My two biggest complaints with this, Drew, were that I'm not convinced that the writers are actually wanting to write a Hawk Girl story. To me, Drew, the feeling I personally got reading this felt like they actually wanted to do a Galaxy miniseries and knew that that wouldn't sell, and so they slapped Hawk Girl's name on it, and then it's really a stealth Galaxy story. That's the way it came across to me. Whether that's going to be the case over the course of the story or not, I don't know. But the first issue felt to me like they were more interested in writing Galaxy than they were in Hawk Girl. And maybe that won't be the case moving forward. But then the other thing is they were just doing too much. There were so many different things going on and so many things. It's a 6-issue miniseries, Drew. A good 6-issue miniseries, to me personally, is a very focused, this is my story and we're telling this story. You don't have time to introduce and spin 5 different plates. You've got 6 issues. You've got to get to the point and tell the story.
I agree with you, because when I read this, it didn't feel like Hawk Girl was the center of the story. And I liked elements of the story also, but I don't know. I just wasn't pulled in the way I should be. And it just didn't feel like Hawk Girl was the main character. So yeah.
It's not a good sign when I finish a comic and I'm like, I'm not convinced that you are actually wanting to write Hawk Girl. I'm not saying that the writers don't like the character. Don't get me wrong. That's not what I'm implying. To me, the story felt like they really wanted to write a Galaxy story, which is fine. I was intrigued by her. I don't know if she's an existing character or not. I don't know. But that they can't get away with that, I guess. I don't know why not. It's not like Hawk Girl's going to sell hotcakes off of the stands either, Drew. So... when I finish a book and I'm not convinced that the title character is really the character you want to write, that's not a good sign.
Agreed. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Night Terrors Catwoman number 1. Catwoman is scouting out a museum when she spots a man wearing clown paint that reminds her of the Joker. The vigilante Sister Zero appears to stop Catwoman from destroying the city again. Apparently, Catwoman's takeover of organized crime failed. Sister Zero is really Sister Magdalene, Selina's sister Maggie. Selina returns to Maggie's church with her and helps with the distribution of food to the poor. Afterward, Maggie agrees to help Selina take down the Joker. Catwoman and Sister Zero check out an amusement park where they find the men armed to the teeth. The two sisters take on the men. Catwoman freaks when Sister Zero is shot at. Luckily, Batman saves her. When Catwoman confronts Batman, Batman is shocked to hear the name Batman. He hasn't told anyone that name yet. Catwoman learns that this is a rookie Batman who's never faced the Joker yet. Batman gets bitten by a snake. The sisters take Batman in a cab back to Maggie's shelter for the homeless. Selina kisses Bruce, and Maggie walks in on them. Maggie is not happy with Selina's behavior. Batman agrees to help Catwoman with the Joker. To be concluded. I did not care for this story, Cletus, honestly.
No, I didn't either. And I got to be honest with you, Drew, that's going to apply to basically all of these Night Terror ones we got this week. These all just felt like a nightmare story for the sake of doing it. Last week, I thought we got some ones that, like hidden gems where like a writer had a really good concept for something to do. And I'm going to sound like a broken record on these, Drew. All of these felt like they had to do, X character in a nightmare, and they just sort of churned something out because that's what this one felt like. I mean, they did a good job, I will say. It had that sort of dream logic to it, which several of these books have done well, where like the story, like certain things don't totally make sense, but it works because it's a dream. It captured that feeling well, but it didn't. I didn't really care. I'm being completely honest with you, it didn't totally feel like the story really cared either.
I agree with you. It felt like some of these writers were like, yeah, I have to do this. Let's just throw something in
And
there.
I'm sure they were. And I frankly don't blame them, Drew. This is the worst part of these events is that you tell these writers who are trying to do their own story, hey, just kidding, you have to do this. And I know it has absolutely nothing with what you're doing. Too bad. Write it. Of course they're going to phone it in. That's why a lot of these are so pointless because the writer doesn't want to do them. But they have to because that's the mandated, this is what the entire line of comics is doing. And so you just get a bunch of phoned in lazy comics. It's just frustrating, Drew. I just put the writers who actually have the idea for the story on it, let them do some, and then let the rest of the books just do their own thing.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Night Terrors Nightwing number 1. Nightwing has been admitted into Arkham Asylum, hosed down by two pig humanoids, and put in a cell. Nightwing feels like he's been drugged and tries to sleep it off. Something under his bed attacks Nightwing, and he falls until he lands in a bloody alley. Nightwing is chased through the alley by men with bulls, dogs, horse, and pig heads. When Nightwing hits a dead end, he stops and fights. Nightwing gets shocked and then wakes up in a chair surrounded by mouse humanoids in doctor and nurse outfits. The warden orders more shock treatment for Nightwing. Nightwing breaks through his bonds with super strength. Both mice rip off their masks to reveal John and Mary Grayson zombies. Nightwing goes to them and they turn to ash. Suddenly, Nightwing is hit by a crowbar. Nightwing wakes up in his bed at Arkham. The man under his bed seems happy that Nightwing is awake. When Nightwing asks the man to come out from under the bed, he refuses. Nightwing tears his bed apart and finally discovers the man is Scarecrow. Scarecrow reveals that Nightwing killed Batman. When Scarecrow is showing Nightwing a map of Arkham so they can escape, Babs is brought into Arkham. To be concluded. Cletus, I like this story even worse than the Catwoman one. And I noticed it wasn't written by Tom Taylor either.
I mean, there's your answer. I mean, I agree, Drew. This one felt even lazier. And I mean, particularly lazy, because what's the cheapest, laziest thing you can do with a Nightwing story? Oh, my nightmare is that I kill Batman. Oh, what an original idea, Drew. And again, it's not written by Taylor, so we're not getting at least the quality of writing that we've been getting from a just brilliant Nightwing run that he's been on. So you're already dealing with a dip in quality there. And again, it's a totally phoned in, unnecessary story. Yeah, I mean, that's all I got to say. And again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but these the ones that we read this week, they felt pointless and I didn't care, and it didn't feel like the writers cared, and it was just a lot of apathy all around, Drew.
Yes. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Night Terrors Punchline Number 1. Punchline and the Royal Flush Gang are immune to whatever is causing the rest of the world to go to sleep. They are attempting to hack into the Bat's computer system. Batgirl Babs shows up and takes out the Royal Flush Gang. Batgirl battles against Punchline and loses. Punchline, happy that she killed Batgirl, leaves on her motorcycle. Punchline arrives at the clock tower to find a way inside. Punchline is thrilled to be in control of Oracle's computer. Before Punchline can access anything, the intruder alarm goes off. Punchline is attacked by a zombie Batgirl. Zombie Batgirl melds with the computer equipment, becoming a twisted, monstrous cyborg. Punchline grabs a cape and jumps out of the window of the clock tower. The cape is a glider that allows Punchline to sail through the air. Punchline's escape is cut short when Zombie Batgirl's mechanical arm stretches out and snatches her from the sky. To be concluded. To me, this was the worst of them.
It wasn't good. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I don't have much more to say about that.
You and I, neither of us like punchlines, so we are not inclined to like this story. I can still recognize a good story when I read it, even if I don't like the character, and this was not one of those times. This was both a character I don't care for and a bad story.
Punchline still felt like she was over the top in it.
Yeah, well, because the story, I know that it's her believing that she's immune to it, but even the story leads with, because I was doing this, I wasn't affected by the dream. And of course, I know, we learned that she was in fact affected by the dream, but still, it's still that same thing of like, I'm so good and I'm so great. Drew, in my experience, I can't think of a Mary Sue character that was a villain before. Like, they're always, those types of characters are always heroes. This is the first one I can think of that's a bad guy, but it has, like, all of the classic characteristics of a Mary Sue.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Night Terror Superman number 1. Superman leaves the Hall of Justice and flies towards Supercore. On his way, Superman runs into a purple wave of energy that causes him to fall asleep. Superman falls from the sky. Clark wakes up from falling asleep at his typewriter at the Daily Planet. Mr. White states that he won't need to write another story ever again. The whole world is saved forever is the front page of the story of the Daily Planet. Lex Luthor appears and stated it was because they worked together to save the world. And when Clark states this isn't real, a tsunami hits Metropolis. When Clark tries to change into Superman, his costume is missing. Lois turns into a water being, stating, "You can't save us all." Clark begins repeating, "It's just a dream. It's just a dream." And Perry states, "Actually, it's a nightmare." Perry rips off his face to reveal Insomnia, who demands the Nightmare Stone. Insomnia shoves Clark out the window and he lands on a mountain of skulls. A skull creature with wings claims he is the Man of Screams, created from his nightmares. Superman only has two paths, Devastation or Solitude. Suddenly, Supergirl appears and punches through an invisible barrier. She is being chased by a group of Supergirl monsters. Superman reminds her, it's all a dream. In the real world, the Aqua family has saved Superman and brought him to a beach. The Atlanteans wonder why they have not been affected. Another Williamson masterpiece.
The thing I feel is necessary to comment on is the end of this, where the reveal seems to be that Aquaman and co. are going to be the key to resolving this conflict. And it is just truly incredible to me, Drew, Williamson's inability to understand literally any character that he writes. I mean, the dialogue that he gives Aquaman, it's two panels worth of dialogue, and yet it is one of the worst portrayals of Aquaman I think I've ever read. That is a gift. He talks like a pirate, and then he states the fact that, like, it's like the most, like, basic internet fact that I feel like everybody knows. Well, actually, the water covers the blah, 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 blah percent of the earth. It's like, yes, you would totally say that in normal conversation, Josh. Great dialogue, dude. Good grief. I mean, I just, like, if the guy could stop sniffing his own farts for 1 second and maybe have somebody proofread his stuff, good God.
All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Night Terrors Wonder Woman number 1. Detective Chimp tries to wake up Wonder Woman, but her face melts off into a pile of goo along with the rest of her body. Bobo sinks into the puddle of goo until the lasso of truth pulls him out. Wonder Woman states they have a league to find. Wonder Woman explains that Zatanna remains awake, but the rest of the Justice League Dark are trapped in this dream world. John Constantine appears and reveals it as the Nightmare Realm, a place created from the collective unconsciousness in which they are being hunted. John uses an answer spell and discovers the rest of the Justice League Dark is in the center of a maze. Bobo states it's obviously a trap. Wonder Woman suggests they use the Lasso of Truth to make their way through the maze. As they are making their way through the maze, the Lasso of Truth suddenly turns into barbed wire. Both John and Bobo let go and are grabbed by monster hands and pulled through the wall, while Wonder Woman is left alone. On the other side of the wall, John and Bobo are attacked by monsters. John attacks them with a flaming magic sword slaughtering them all, but only briefly as they reform in greater numbers. Both run for their lives. John is separated from Bobo and runs down a flight of stairs into another chamber. There he finds Xantana, who is not happy to see him. As Xantana walks away from him, John is trapped as a tree grows around him. Meanwhile, Wonder Woman punches her way through the wall looking for John and Bobo. They are not on the other side. Instead, Wonder Woman comes across a golden shield and she stares at her reflection. Suddenly, the reflection's hair turns into snakes and her face into a golden mask. A monstrous version of Wonder Woman with six arms and two legs holding a golden mace exits the shield. It attacks Wonder Woman. As Wonder Woman battles the creature, it turns into a gigantic snake. When Bobo finds Wonder Woman, the giant snake chomps its jaws on her. Is this the death of Wonder Woman? Find out in our final issue, Night Terrors Wonder Woman number 2. We also had a backup story in this, Nubia and the Well of Horrors part 1. Themyscira. Nubia wakes up and tells Io she is snoring. When Nubia realizes Io is not in bed with her, she jumps to her feet. Suddenly, Nubia is in front of the Well of Souls. A voice calls out, "Help me, Queen Nubia, please!" Nubia leans over the well and calls for Magala. A hand reaches up out of the well and pulls her in. As Nubia is falling, her pajamas change into her costume and cape, and her weapon appears in her hand. When Nubia lands, a woman asks if she is all right. It is Seraph, one of the last keepers of the Below. Nubia has never heard of her. Nubia asks Seraph if she knows what happened to Magala. She replies that she does not. Seraph informs Nubia that the creatures of the depth of Tartarus have infected the Well of Souls, preventing souls from leaving, and even Gaia is in danger. Seraph leads Nubia into another chamber where she is attacked by monsters. Nubia notices the creatures were freed and did not escape. Seraph transforms, stating she ran out of food. The souls were not enough. Gaia will devour you and the rest of this island. To be continued. Now, it wasn't the best issue, Cletus, but I did enjoy this more than the other ones.
I mean, that's such a low bar to cross, though. The thing I actually have to comment on this is, not to be clear, not the comic's fault, and in physical form is not a problem at all, and I quite like the layout. But reading on the stupid Kindle app, Drew, this comic was a damn nightmare. It was like custom designed to be the worst readability possible for that reader. And again, I want to be very clear, this is an indictment 100% on the Kindle readers' stupid comic book adaptability. And not the comic itself, but my gosh, I was so annoyed by the end of this comic, Drew.
It didn't bother me that much. Maybe because I was more focused on getting my notes done.
The whole thing, so for our readers who haven't read this, most of the Wonder Woman part of the story is told across two-page spreads that is like, the artwork is going across the pages, but is sort of like paneled in creative ways. And the Kindle reader does not handle two-page spreads well. It puts it way too small, so you have to zoom in into each panel individually, which then you can read it, but then you're losing the effect of the page because, again, the artwork is meant to go across the entire page. And this one had both, like, across-the-page spread panel, but then individual panels below that, and so it would have to, like, zoom out to show you what you're looking at, for one thing, that was a little bit too small to read, and then zoom way in into a tiny part of one of these individual small panels so that you could read that, but then you're losing like the feel of where you are in the comic and what, you know, what's going on around it. Comics are such a visual medium, and the construction of the page as a whole I feel is so important. And again, I want to be very clear, this is a Kindle problem, but this comic was like, it felt especially designed to highlight some of the worst aspects of the reader.
One of the things I thought was cool in this story, Cletus, was when they were going through the maze and they had to hold on to the lasso of truth, and then it suddenly turned into barbed wire. I was like, whoa, I hadn't seen that before. I just thought that was a cool idea.
I agree. I would have... My one frustration narratively with this story, Drew, is it was the most unclear... Were we looking at a nightmare, or were we looking at some version of reality Was it a mix? Because all of the characters seem to have their own autonomy. Right? Like, the stuff that's happening suggests that it's a nightmare. But then we go and follow John and Bobo on their own, which wouldn't make sense if it's Wonder Woman's nightmare. And that ambiguity was not great in terms of understanding what was going on, what was really going on.
Well, John stated at the beginning of the comic that they were in the nightmare realm and there was a collective unconsciousness. So they established that at the beginning of the issue. I knew they were in a dream realm, stuck in there, and the rest of the Justice League Dark was in there as well, and they were looking for him. So I understood that part, what was going on. So I wasn't confused by that at all. They were.
But why are they able to be? I guess the comic, to me, Drew, the comic didn't do enough. And some of that might be my fault as a reader, to be clear. I don't want to put all of this on the comic, but I didn't get enough explanation other than they're magic users as to why they were able to be together and everybody else has been completely separate and lost in their own dreams. Because, like, even in the Superman issue that we read, Drew, Supergirl punches through reality into his, but then we see very quickly that that's part of the dream, right? That is, by all indications, that's not actually Supergirl. Also, side note, leave it to Williamson to have that be Supergirl and not Power Girl, who we've just done a story with her doing that. Anyway, but you know what I mean? So I didn't get, going back to this, I didn't think a sufficient enough explanation of why they are in a shared realm. What did they do that, Drew?
That's a good question. I didn't explain that.
And why does, once they're in the dream, why is they make such a point of the lasso being, you know, like a get out of jail free card, essentially. And then it clearly, dream logic applies to the lasso because, like you said, it turns to barbed wire, which I want to be clear is a very cool idea, but it's an idea that makes a ton of sense if Wonder Woman is just lost in her own nightmare, right? Where the lasso isn't really real and it's part of the nightmare. We're told, like you said, that they're in this dream realm. How, to me, was unclear that they were together. And it seemed like part of it was because they were using the lasso, but then the lasso is part of the nightmare, Drew, because it transforms. So it was inconsistent. And I felt like I was spending too much time to figure out, I was like, okay, what? All of these stories have been nightmares where the character isn't sure what's going on, but we, the reader, know relatively what is actually happening. And this was the only one where I felt possibly more confused than the characters.
He spent too much time trying to figure out. I didn't care
But that's the thing, Drew. It's not a good enough. This is what, like, I agree. Relatively speaking, it was better than the other nightmare stories that we read. I agree. But it wasn't good enough to justify the confusion. I was like, man, this isn't worth it. Like, this story's not good enough for me to be this confused. Like, what are we doing?
So, I have a feeling I enjoyed it just a little more than you did. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk Blue Beetle.
For over 6 years, the 42 Cast has worked to provide panels discussing topics from every corner of the geekosphere. Continue with us as we count down to episode 200 and try something a little different. Celebrity guest contributions. Yes, Emma Dumont from The Gifted is partnering with us to talk about science, movies, and so much more. You can only find this great content on the 42 Cast. It's your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything.
People keep asking, are we back? Yeah, I guess we're back. Back to talk about cigars, movies, TV shows, and any other nerdy topics here on the Cigar Nerds Podcast. Check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com and ESONetwork.com. And we have a YouTube channel at Cigar Nerd Podcast, where we do cigar reviews, live versions of the show, and any other dumb thing we think to record.
And we're back. Let's talk Blue Beetle. An alien scarab chooses college graduate Jaime Reyes to be a symbiotic host, bestowing the teenager with a suit of armor that's capable of extraordinary and unpredictable powers, forever changing his destiny as he becomes the superhero known as Blue Beetle.
Overall impressions, Drew, I liked this film. I think it's the best one that they put out this year, but it's not. I mean, it's not a masterpiece either. It's in a similar vein of both Shazam 2 and The Flash, which is they're pretty good. They're entertaining. This one was certainly better, had far fewer flaws than the other two did. But I would also argue part of that is because it played it incredibly safe. I thought this was just a very well-executed, paint-by-numbers superhero origin film to me, Drew. Is ultimately my impression. I thought there was some stuff they did very, very well. The Blue Beetle costume looks terrific. I mean, they did that so well. It looks awesome. I thought the cast was pretty good. The actor playing Jaime was great. I have no complaints there at all. I really, really like how they were able to portray the history of Blue Beetle and even characterize Ted. I thought Ted got a pretty good characterization for somebody who literally doesn't appear on screen. Like, even my wife, who knows nothing about comics, Drew, came out of the film and felt like she kind of understood Ted as a character, which is a testament to how, with very little, and while absolutely keeping the focus, as they should, on Jaime, I thought they did a great job kind of representing the legacy that led up to Jaime. So that was, by far, the best part of the film. So they did all of that really well, but it also, I mean, it was so, you know, it hit all of the beats you expect a superhero origin film to make. I wasn't surprised by any of the developments during the plot, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but again, it's very safe, and I do think that lowers the ceiling of how good a film can be. Well, it raises the floor, like, it can't be that bad, and this wasn't. It was pretty good, but it was very safe. And you know what would have been perfect for a film like this, Drew? A max release.
Exactly. When I was at the movie theater, I was thinking that same thing, because the movie, like you said, it felt like a Shazam movie, but one of the things that came to my mind was when I was watching this is like a Shazam. And the other movie that popped in my head was Sky High. It felt like that type of a movie, because it felt like it was geared towards kids a little bit. Even though there was quite a bit of language in it, it felt very family-oriented to me. And we even see that with the family dynamic during the movie. That's the two things I loved about this movie, the family dynamic and the legacy of it. Because not only did we have Ted Kord's legacy in it, we had Dan Garrett's legacy in it also. And that's one of the things I loved about this, was the legacy in it. And I knew we were going to get to see the bug in the movie. I didn't think we were going to get to see the bug in action in this movie. And I freaking loved it. One of the characters I loved in this movie was George Lopez's character. And him flying the bug, oh man, I geeked out. This was a fun movie. I loved it. It's not the greatest thing out there. I put it up with Shazam and Sky High, kind of like how I like watching those movies. You know, they don't take themselves too seriously, and they're just fun to watch. That's what I felt like when I was watching this.
It's the perfect streaming film, Drew. Again, it's not daring. It's not doing anything. It is the first lead Latino superhero, and that is important, and that's cool. But other than that, that's really the only defining new thing that it's doing. It's the perfect streaming movie. It's the exact kind of thing where you're like, hey, what do you want to watch this weekend? Oh, there's a Blue Beetle movie out. I don't really know anything about that character. Let's check it out. And then it's pretty good, right? And you finish streaming it, and you're like, hey, 2 hours well spent. I enjoyed my 2 hours. This shouldn't have been a box office film. There's no universe in which this film ever is going to be a blockbuster, Drew. It's not that kind of movie. It just isn't. Now, if you slap the Marvel label on it, I'm sure it makes several hundred million more, because they have the built-in audience and people will just naturally go and see it. And DC is the exact opposite of that, where whatever the audience would be, you can subtract several million. Because of the title, but I'm so frustrated that they put this out in theaters, Drew, because not because the film is bad, but because this wasn't the right spot for the film. And it's not doing this film justice, because if this came out on Max last weekend, you would have only gotten positive buzz about it. You would have, because people would have watched it. And I think it, like, you look on Rotten Tomatoes and you look at the audience score for this, people like the movie, Drew. It's a well-received film. We're not the only ones that like this the best of the three. It is pretty unanimously the best-received DC film that's come out this year. Think about that coming out on Max. That's only positive buzz. That is only good things, relatively speaking, coming out in, you know, the articles and whatever, which is what DC needs, Drew. They need a win. They don't need DC. Like, instead, the article is Blue Beetle technically finishes number one, barely beating Barbie, who's been in theaters for 6 weeks. That's not the news that you need, Drew. That's not the thing that convinces people that your films aren't box office poison.
No, I saw a lot of comments about this movie online, too, and a lot of people seem to like it. But, you know, I also saw the article saying, you know, DC movie bombs at box office kind of thing. And it's like, of course.
Of course.
This was made for Max originally, and Zaslav, or whatever his name is, you know, yep. we gotta put it on the big screen. Well, guess what, buddy? It tanked again.
I don't know if there's a metric to show. There's not a metric that can really show this, Drew, but I wish you could show that, yes, I am sure that the movie is making more money being in a theater than if you just put it on Max, obviously. But is the money that you make short-term from a limited box office release, because this isn't going to have legs, it didn't make enough money, over the long-term continual damage to your reputation as a studio, right? Like, I wish you could show that, like, there was some sort of metric, like, yes, we're going to make roughly $100 million, hopefully, worldwide off of this movie, but at the cost of subtract another $200 million from the next film, because yet again, we bombed at the box office. That seems to be the trade-off that DC keeps making, which is like, well, let's release it anyway. And, oh, okay, well, it didn't do great, but maybe the next one will. But then that one does worse because people continue to learn to not go to these movies. Now, I'm not saying that Blue Beetle deserves that. It doesn't. It's a pretty good film. And again, if it was a Max release, all we would get is positive stuff about this. There are flaws in the film. Don't get me wrong. It's, you know, it's a solid B-plus film for me. But it's really enjoyable. And it, as a streaming movie, it's an ideal streaming experience because it's a very pleasant, enjoyable movie. And after you finish it, you're like, that was nice. I enjoyed myself. I enjoyed my 2 hours. And that is good for streaming. You know what that's not good enough for? The box office right now, Drew. That's not good enough.
No, people aren't going to the movies. I mean, there may be one or two movies people are like, yeah, I got to go see that. But for the most part, they're just not going to movies just to see anything. People are very selective of what they want to see. This is not a movie that people are going to want to go spend money at the box office.
In large part, because DC doesn't have that world, you don't have the built-in audience that feels like they have to see it to get the next chapter in a story. Right? This is a very self-contained chapter, which I think suits the movie well. And I don't mean this as a criticism for the film. This is a criticism towards it being a theatrical release. As a theatrical release, this movie, there's just not enough there to convince people to go see it.
Now, just like we thought, there wasn't really any connectivity to the other movies. Though we had mentioned, I think they mentioned both Superman and Batman in it.
If I remember. Flash.
And Flash, too. I remember mentioning him.
Another character, too. They did. One thing I thought they did well, Drew, is that the spotlight stayed on Jaime the whole time, which is what you want. So Jaime's the main character, and they never pulled attention away from that. But they still, in very subtle ways, made it feel like a world in which superheroes exist, right? Like, the idea of Jaime being a superhero was crazy in that it was their son. Right? That was the thing that was weird. It wasn't the concept of a superhero at all. Right? Like, this was a world in which superheroes existed. Previous Blue Beetles. Superman's out there somewhere. They mentioned Central City in The Flash. They mentioned Batman. You know what I mean? And I thought the movie did that well, and they did it in such a subtle way. It's not surprising that Gunn wants to keep this for his universe, again, because they do this the character justice. This is a good Blue Beetle. But also, I mean, they didn't commit to anything. This film could exist in basically any DC universe.
Yeah, you're right. It could. I like the fact that when they did the movie, we had that after credit scene where Ted's still alive. And I thought it would have been cool if they would have had Ted with Booster, maybe traveling through time or something. I was hoping that would be the case.
Drew, I wonder. So we do know that this gun wants to keep this. And as of now, they still do. Well, maybe things will change. But one thing that they can do, remember, they are doing a Booster Gold Max series. You can bring Ted back without necessarily having Ted be the Blue Beetle 2 story. Like, who knows if they'll even make a Blue Beetle 2, right? But if they do, Ted doesn't have to be the story. Ted can be in the Booster Gold story. And you can bring Jaime along, too. Hell, that could be part of what the series is about, is them figuring out where Ted is. I think that that's a really cool possibility and a great way to start building towards a truly connected Marvel-style universe.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And is it the Black Beetle or the Dark Beetle?
From the comics?
Yeah, from the comics.
I think it's Black Beetle.
It's Black Beetle. They could actually have Booster Gold and Ted dealing with the Black Beetle, too.
Who knows? And who knows if Booster will even have anything with Ted. But I found that one thing I found interesting with the tease at the end, Drew, is that in an ideal world where Superman succeeds and we do finally get a truly connected universe off the ground, is that the Ted mystery doesn't necessarily have to come to fruition in Blue Beetle 2. That can be its own thing, and Jaime's next story can still be something on his own. One thing I found fascinating, Drew, is that they didn't really touch on the Reach at all.
No, they didn't.
And they changed a little the relationship between the Beetle and between Kaji Da and Jaime was different and much less antagonistic than it initially is in the comics, because they reference and they hint that it's an alien weapon, but they skim the surface pretty lightly on that, right? And then they focus more. To me, Drew, the Beetle felt more like a Green Lantern ring in the way they were like, it chose you, and it's, you know what I mean? But that leaves the door open potentially for that being Blue Beetle 2, if that ever happens, is now you can tell a Reach story. And I think that works. I think it let them tell a ground is not doing the Reach, I think, was the right idea, Drew. Because I feel like you probably get a sky beam, which was about the only generic superhero thing that was missing from the film, thankfully. And by not doing the Reach, I thought it kept the story more grounded and more focused, because I can't imagine Grandma going up into space and doing the same thing. So,
oh, man, she was a great character, too. Don't mess with Nana.
So one thing I want to compliment the film on. So the highest praise I have for the film is the way they portrayed the Blue Beetle legacy. That was just unbelievably done. That was so well done. And I hope future superhero films take note of how they did that, because we didn't get exposition dumps on it, Drew. We didn't spend an inordinate amount of screen time focusing on it. They accomplished a ton in very little time giving you that legacy element. And that was just incredibly well done by the film. But another thing that I have to praise the film for doing is the family going to rescue Jaime is everything that normally, Drew, in a film I hate. I just don't like those kind of things where the film really stretches your sense of disbelief to be like, hey, these normal people are going to go into a situation where the superpowered character couldn't cut it, and then they're going to go in and fix the problem themselves, and you have to believe that. I struggle with that a lot, and some of the worst superhero stuff that we've seen do that poorly. And there was a lot here, Drew, that I was like, when they initially went down that road and the family is going to rescue Jaime, I was like, oh no, I'm not going to like this. But they did it. They walked that tightrope. And I think one of the things that they did well, keeping on the right side of that tightrope, keeping it believable, keeping the focus still on Jaime, is that the family goes to rescue Jaime, but they don't do it that well. And the movie makes it very clear that it only succeeds because of Jaime, right? Like, the sister is able to protect herself temporarily and fend off an opponent temporarily, but the film makes it pretty clear that if Jaime doesn't show up within a minute, that she's dead. And I thought that they did that well, and that helped me continue to enjoy the film and not suspend my disbelief too much, because yes, they go to rescue him, but they are reliant on the beetle, which, like you said, was incredible. Incredible that we got to see that on screen. But they're reliant on the beetle doing the work, and they're reliant on Jaime breaking free and helping to protect them. That it's not that, you know, normal people suddenly just becoming otherworldly, you know, opponent smashers.
The other thing I think the movie did well was establish that, you know, how close-knit this family is, how they get into each other's business. Even the scene where he goes off to work and they're like honking the horn and and just embarrassing him, it makes sense that they'd go rescue him. And I like the fact that, yeah, they wouldn't be able to do it without the beetle helping him. So it made total sense. The other thing I liked in this movie that was the fact that we had Ted Kord's daughter in this, and she was kind of the mentor figure with Ted missing. Because I think the movie kind of needed that to bring in the legacy stuff. Now, I was like, I don't think Ted ever had a daughter in the comics that I was aware of.
I don't think so.
So she was a new character, but you needed that connectivity to Ted, and I think it worked well. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, they had some sort of cartoon in the movie, and then that very last credit scene at the end, which I felt like I wasted my time staying that long, because I didn't know what the heck that was. I had a feeling you probably didn't either. It felt like it was old school and maybe something to do with Hispanic heritage, maybe type of cartoon.
I don't know what it is either, Drew, but I was under the impression that that was a real thing and not something they made up for the film. It was definitely some sort of Hispanic satire of superheroes, right? Because the stuff that he does isn't really, like, he struggles to actually open the pickle jar and stuff. I don't know. I didn't feel like I was the target audience for that joke, Drew.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I was either.
Okay. And that's, I mean, like I say, I agree with you. It was a little bit frustrating as the end credit scene. It was like, oh, come on. But it's okay. I mean, it's great that they've given, you know, Latinos, you know, their own superhero, like they make the point in the film. And there are jokes that are obviously targeted towards that demographic, which is good, Drew. And I'm okay with not getting that joke. I would like if I got it, but I did not get it.
Now, when we read Blue Beetle Graduation Day, remember how we had the mix of English and Spanish in the comic book, and we didn't know what the heck they were talking about when they had the Spanish stuff in there. Mm-hmm. I like how the movie had their mix of English and Spanish, but they had the subtitles on there. So, you know, I don't know. I thought the mix they had in the movie was a good mix. It wasn't too much, and there wasn't too much subtitles we had to read. I liked it.
I agree. One thing they did well, too, with that, Drew, is they didn't always have subtitles, because there were certain things that they didn't, but you could, I obviously didn't know what they were saying, but you could pick up the gist of what they were getting at. Some of it felt like they were maybe being less than nice, but you know what I mean? But that made sense. Like, when it was important, and that was the thing I thought that occasionally the comic was missing, is it felt like in the comic there was some dialogue that I frankly felt like I needed to understand, and it was choosing not to translate, and that was frustrating. It felt like anytime they were saying something in Spanish that you needed to actually know, they gave you subtitles. And when you didn't really need to know what they were saying, they just left it for you to sort of pick it up, you know, based on the attitude. And I liked that. I thought that was a good blend. I thought that was a good compromise that the comic could have used also.
Another thing I liked in this movie was the choice of OMAC and needing the Beatles technology to complete that, you know, make that operational. It kind of worked with this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I like OMAC. I thought worked as a villain. I liked the design of the both the like early version of OMAC and then the one that we saw at the end. That was cool. I thought the movie did a great job of not falling into being too CGI heavy at the end, Drew. It felt more like the first Iron Man clash at the end, where it still felt personal, you know what I mean, and not just a mess of CGI action figures. I thought they did that well. So a couple things I would have liked the movie to have done better. The big one, Susan Sarandon's character is certainly villainous, but she was almost like, she felt too black and white villainous, Drew. It felt like they tried to give her a little bit of depth, but it seemed sort of like, well, they gave the promotion to my brother instead, so now I'm evil. And it was like, that's lame. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, I certainly bought into her being bad, but I would have liked a little bit more depth to her character than that, without necessarily giving more screen time, but just more justification for what she's doing. It felt a lot of like evil for evil's sake. And I don't get me wrong, I am sure there are a lot of CEOs out there that are just like her and acting purely out of greed and self-interest. I'm not saying it's not realistic, but just a tiny bit more depth would have been nice.
I agree with you. And I think that has to do with the writing, not her actual portrayal, because I think she did the best that she could with what was written.
I agree. There's nothing there for her to do. I totally agree. It's not on Sarandon. That's what that role was. Not on her at all. I really didn't have a complaint with any of the acting, Drew. I thought the acting was solid all around. The other thing, and this would probably be my biggest complaint on the film, Drew, is I would have loved a more back and forth between Jaime and the Beetle and more of a relationship between the two, because I felt like the film was very inconsistent on how autonomous the Beetle was, if that makes sense. Like, they talk about them reaching synergy and becoming together, and the Beetle is choosing you, but the Beetle was so non-existent for most of the film as a character. And so when at the end of the film, again, double spoilers, at the end of the film, when the Beetle prevents Jaime from killing OMAC, it felt off for me for two reasons. As a comic book fan, it felt off because obviously that's the complete reverse from what it is in the comics. But I get what they were doing it for the movie. But it also felt off because the Beetle hadn't consistently been a character. I would have liked more with that, and I would have liked to have seen more evolution of their relationship, because it kind of felt like they went from 0 to 60 in terms of being a team as a Beetle. And part of that is the nature of, this is the downside of 2-hour superhero films, is that you kind of have to yada yada certain parts of the plot. But I felt like they kind of did that yada 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 with the Beetle, and that felt a little too important to do that with.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment on that, you know, because we didn't really see much interaction between the two until towards the end of the movie, so I would have liked to see that develop more too.
It's one of the cool things about Jaime's character is the back and forth is the distinct personality difference between the two. In the comics, Kaji Da is much more prone to violence, and Jaime is constantly holding the Beetle back. And I like the idea that the film has of, like, we do see Jaime trying to hold the Beetle back, but it's, again, it's very few times and in very limited, you know, limited in scope. And I like the idea of flipping it on its head at the end, that, like, Jaime keeps stopping it. And finally the Beetle's like, no, you stop. I like the idea of that, Drew, but it just didn't feel earned in the film because we didn't see enough of that between the two.
Yeah, it needed to be developed out more. I agree with you. All right. Anything else you want to say about this movie before we wrap it up?
Again, I think it's a pretty good film, Drew. I just think it's a perfect film for streaming. It felt, as I watched it, again, I enjoyed this film. It really was. I immediately, when the film ended, I was like, that's the best one they've done this year. So I want to praise the film, but it should have been a streaming film. And they did such a disservice to this film by putting it in the box office and opening it to criticism that they, frankly, DC can't afford to have. And I just don't understand why they did that, other than Zaslav's an idiot who can't see past the immediate dollars.
Agree. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, so I wanted to go through all three origins. Just like the film did a fantastic job of acknowledging the history of all of the Blue Beetles, Blue Beetle has been around since the Golden Age, Drew. And one thing that's fascinating is that Dan Garrett himself went through a transformation on who he was. So Dan Garrett's Blue Beetle originally appears in Mystery Men Comics number 1, which is, to be clear, not a DC comic, in 1939. But in that, it's not even the Dan Garrett that we're familiar with. And so then in the 60s, so the character kind of fades away, as with like all Golden Age stuff kind of goes away. And then we get the revival of superheroes in the Silver Age. And in 1964, Charlton Comics has the character now and had reprinted some of the stories. And they reinvent him as the archaeologist who finds this beetle and uses the magic words Kaji Da, which the movie kind of gave a shout out to when Blue Beetle is shooting Omak at the end and shouts out Kaji Da's name. Was a nice kind of reference to that's how the Dan Garrett character would sort of use the powers of the Beetle. Didn't totally work in the film, I thought, because it didn't make sense, but it was a nice reference to that. Then we get the Ted Kord character, Drew, first appears in Captain Atom 83 in 1966. Again, this is still not DC Comics. This is still Charlton Comics, because as some people will know, Owlman from Watchmen was originally supposed to be Ted Kord, Blue Beetle, when they went over to DC. And then finally, we get Jaime pops up for the first time in Infinite Crisis number 3 in 2006 by Geoff Johns. And this was after the death of Ted Kord that was lead in the build up to Infinite Crisis. So it's a very, very old character, but has gone through many transformations as to what the character is and how they are. And it's a very interesting, fascinating history to the character, and it's something I thought the film did just a magnificent job showing.
All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about the classic cover of the week for our newsletter, because in our last episode about the Legion of Superheroes animated movie, I decided to pick out a classic Legion of Superheroes cover that I put in there, and I did one the week before. This is something new I just started in our newsletter. I thought it'd be cool. I don't even know where I got the idea, but I thought it'd be cool to put classic covers in the newsletter, so you may see one of these that Cletus put on there, or was talking about for his shout-out, or you may see something else that I pull in for classic cover, but you can probably bet it's going to be Blue Beetle related. So, just another addition to our newsletter that I thought would be fun. Alright, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at a feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Superman, The Last Days of Lex Luthor, Batman, The Brave and the Bold, Night Terrors number 2, Night Terrors Action Comics, Night Terrors Angel Breaker, Night Terrors Detective Comics, Night Terrors Harley Quinn, Night Terrors Titans, and we're going back to Titans, reviewing Titans Season 4, Episode 7. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.